Hey friends, Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason, and welcome to this edition of our program. We spend a lot of time at STR talking about how we can make a difference in our culture as ambassadors for Christ. And sometimes what that does is obscure what I consider the primary purpose of Stand to Reason, and that is to make disciples. I mean, I got discipleship in my blood, and it wasn't until about 4 or 5 years ago that this became really clear to me. Now, I have been actively making disciples for years and years and years, and it just seems like, yeah, no duh, Greg, because I've had groups over the years of many different kinds. Most of my staff has been in a group at my home for a year one time or another, but for some reason, it just gelled for me as I was thinking, what you really care about is mentoring. It's not evangelism. It's discipleship. And this is why I'm glad at Stand to Reason we've been able to help thousands and thousands of Christians over the last 28 years to go deeper and to think more clearly and to gain the knowledge and the tactical skills that they need to represent Christ with confidence and with grace. And we want to build your confidence, and we want to. But, you know, we haven't been doing this alone. We have been doing this with a cadre. And I love that word, because the word cadre is meant to kind of identify a group of military warriors, let's put it this way, not combatants like they're there to fight, but they're warriors. They're ready to get out there and stand in the light of fire in some sense and really do the job. And that's what I think of our strategic partners. This is one of the reasons that this month we've been asking people to consider taking a bold step and becoming what we call one of the 100 new strategic partners. We've actually done this last year in August and the year before in August, and it's really worked out well for us and for you, for the many people who said, all right, I want to take a step and be part of that cadre. Now, strategic partners have made a monthly financial commitment. They're not just people who send to us, which we greatly appreciate, all of you. Every one of you. But these are folks that said, we want to be part of a team that makes a monthly commitment, a financial commitment, and in so doing, that makes them a member of a critically important inside group at STR. You strategic partners are our financial bedrock. And that's why, for the rest of you listening, I just want to invite you to be a member of that team, to be one of the 100. And when you sign up, I'll tell you about some of the things that we're going to send to you. But what I want to do first is I want to talk to one of our strategic partners. And in this case, he's one of my favorite people from the Stand to Reason community. His name is Mark Berry. Mark, how you doing today?
Greg, hi. I'm here. Can you hear me?
I sure can.
Outstanding.
I am so thrilled to chat with you, partly because I haven't talked to you in a while. And your relationship with us at STR has actually blossomed into a really wonderful friendship between our families over the last few years, hasn't it?
Indeed, it has. That's been a great blessing to us. And as I heard your intro, I said, you know what? You can call me an STR combatant if you want. You can call me an STR a cadre. You can call me. I'm glad to be part of the team, whatever you want to call it.
Warrior. Yeah. Well,
yes, absolutely.
Well, I think the way we first got to know, you can correct my memory here because my memory is not so good. You're younger than I, you remember better. But I think the first time I did some work in San Antonio where you live, and instead of staying in a hotel, you invited me to stay in your home with your family and your rather large family. And that's how I got to know you more personally. Is that the first time that we connected, or was there another occasion?
No, that's right. That's correct. We invited you down to what we called the Francis Schaeffer Conference, just to speak to our church and to the community. And I had heard you speak of Francis Schaeffer and his influence in your ministry and your life, your spiritual life. And I knew that you'd be a wonderful speaker, and you came, lectured for a couple of days, and I had asked Melinda, is there any way, does he ever stay with somebody, or does he just want to have his private time in a hotel? Because I had hoped we could spend even some more private time, and it was special.
Well, we get to do that. I do on occasion. And, of course, in this case, it was magnificent. You and Sue, your wife, opened your home to me, and you have a passel of kids, and they're not youngsters. I mean, the full range, I think. You had maybe one or two in medical school at the time, and maybe more now. I don't know. You're both doctors, both of you, Mark and Sue, are both for the people's awareness there. But homeschooled your kids, and folks, this is also one thing that endeared me to them is not only their love for the Lord, their love for each other, and their wonderful hospitality and their wonderful home. This is a tennis family. And I played competitive tennis for like 20 years, but it had been a long time since I'd been on a court. Nevertheless, I was able to get out there with the kids who, all of your kids were so good that they could hit the ball right to me, which made my life a lot easier on the court. I do recall falling over at one point because my mind was writing checks my body couldn't cash. But it was such a sensational time that I was able to spend there with you guys. And I'll just tell you, and again, this is not so much about strategic partner stuff. It's just about the friendship that I was able to develop with you and your family. That was so sweet to me. I came back home and I told my family, I said, I have never met a family that was more in love with each other. And I know we spent more time together in the mountains and whatever at another time while we're on Christmas time. And we know families are families, right? There's all kinds of dynamics. But it was so sweet to be with you because it was so obvious that everybody, all the kids, everybody loved each other so much and enjoyed being with each other so much. It was so satisfying for me to hang out with you guys.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. And we are blessed and have definitely feel like the Lord has done that work in our family, and to be able to hang out with you and continue to glean from you, it was kind of unexpected, actually, but it kind of, in some ways, made me realize there are so many fellow believers that we just haven't met, and to be mm-hmm. able to get to know them better, I guess we can look forward to eternity, because there's you mentor so many people. And it's probably only just a small number you're able to have the time for. And yet, when you do, it's quite special.
Yeah, well, it was special for me, too. Now, you're a Baylor family, top to bottom, as I recall. And you guys, you and Sue were Baylor students. Your kids have graduated. You probably still got some kids at Baylor. But I recall you brought a whole bunch at one time. At one point, your kids came back from Baylor because I was staying with you. And then we had an evening together with a whole bunch of other Baylor kids that they mm-hmm. dragged with them and just had this interactive discussion that was magnificent. So I'm curious.
It was like the Schaefer. It was the Schaefer conference. And I had this idea that it could almost be a LaBrie moment where we could gather inquiring students mm-hmm. at your feet almost and ask questions and just sort of explore difficult questions. Mm-hmm. And it just turned out to be an amazing time. And mm-hmm. indeed, there just were all kinds of questions. And there you were in the midst, just giving them wisdom and encouragement. Yeah, and so it was very special.
It was actually interesting for me because I actually did sit at the feet of Francis Schaefer at LaBrie during a Q&A session while he was sitting in front of the fireplace there in Huemo, in the Swiss Alps, answering questions of a bunch of hippies, back in the mid-70s. So it was like this was a little kind of a crazy thing that was going on for me, seeing that same thing kind of happen there. But what I'm interested in right now, Mark, is, I mean, that's all part of our relationship and just sweet how that developed. And it was your taking advantage of the kinds of things that Stand to Reason provided that helped you and your wife and your family build that community in some ways. There were other influences, of course, but that also led to that wonderful relationship that we've been able to have over the years. But mm-hmm. I don't know that I recall you telling me how you first connected with STR.
If you could tell me when you were interviewed on Hank Hanegraaff's The Bible Answer Man, that will tell you when I first heard
you. Oh, my goodness. That was a long time ago. Was it on was it on Tactics? Because I was on a show a number of times.
But it was,
I haven't been on for a long time, and so that was kind of a different era. That was before the first Tactic book was published. And what was it, 2019 was the 10-year anniversary, so that must have been 2009. It had to be sometime before 2009, probably more like 2008 or 2007 when I was on.
Yeah. I knew it had been, I thought it had been like 2005 even. I knew
it was a long time ago.
But I tuned in, and I wasn't even a regular listener to his program, but I just randomly tuned in, and I heard your voice and heard you explaining these tactics, and I was just transfixed. I thought, I need to hear more of this, and I promptly ordered the Tactics. I guess it was on DVD.
Yes,
possibly,
right. The book wasn't out then. Right. It,
yeah.
It was
and,
CD. Yeah, it was a package deal that he offered. We sold it here, but we kind of arranged with him to make it available to you guys. And so that was before the book even came out. The first book even came out.
Yeah. Well, I just it was so helpful. But I am the sort of person that likes to understand problems, and I like to. When I become convinced, I can be passionate about things I hold to be true, and yet I think over the years had been somewhat frustrated because as I engage people in discussions, they can turn into arguments, and my goal had always been I'm going to win the argument, I'm going to win the day, and for the cause of Christ, but it turns out that it just wasn't winsome, and often it was frustrating because people start shutting down, and then the conversation doesn't go where you want it to go. You don't ultimately make a difference, and I think to hear your tactics and just to encourage me to back off a little, ask questions, just the Columbo tactic and those sorts of things, and realize that your goal is the relationship with people. Your goal is not to win the argument, but maybe it's just something more simple, just to, quote, put the stone in the shoe.
Right.
And that was so helpful for me to realize that I've got to stop being so overbearing and insistent that they see it right away, right now. Let the Spirit work, possibly, if that's going to happen. And so the tactical approach was just, it was something I needed and didn't even know I needed it. But as I look back over my experience trying to engage people on issues that matter for Christ, it was full of frustration. And this was so important to me. I began tuning in and hearing the podcast. And I can tell you, I can remember trip after trip, I went back and just listened to as many podcasts as I could. I don't even know when the podcast came out, actually. But I found myself at driving these long trips on vacations, and I would be the only one awake, and everybody else was asleep in the back, just going through these podcasts and thinking, that is a great question. And I felt like I was being mentored and really equipped. And that was so helpful. Eventually, I started including my kids and saying, you've got to listen to this. This is we need to have this conversation. We need to talk. And so it became then a stepping stone to help also me shepherd my children. And that was, so it's, I think we've even seen sort of a generation though, Greg. It's not only have you mentored me and then in so doing, it made me a better mentor for my sons and daughters. They actually were helpful in starting an apologetics group up at Baylor, which didn't exist. And so that was actually the group that we brought down to the Schaefer Conference, probably 10 or 20 kids that wanted to know more and how to think critically about Christian matters. And,
right.
and so it's borne fruit, you know, in a way that I never expected.
Yeah, that's the group that has the funny bear name, right?
That's right.
That's what
you
I
know, they
remember.
Weren't allowed to use Ratio Christi, apparently, sadly, at a Christian university that somehow they saw that as controversial. So they came up with Oso, which means bear, and Oso, logos, the word, bear, as sort of studying the word, I guess.
I guess
and,
so. Yeah.
So is there an apologetics group, and it's still thriving?
Yeah. Another question for you, though, Mark, because and I don't know anything about your giving history except for your strategic partner. So I mean, at some point, you either began giving to Stand to Reason at some level, or maybe you jumped right into being a strategic partner. Just tell us about what motivated you to make.
Was giving. I don't even think you called it strategic partners when I started giving, but it became clear to me that you were really ministering and serving and shepherding my heart. And so at some point 10 or 15 years ago, I said, I really feel like I want to support this group and may God bless you and continue to help you do for others what you've done for me and for my family and others. Yeah. So it's been quite a while and I have been very blessed to be able to do that and want to continue to do so.
Yeah, Mark, thank you and Sue for your help there, and your whole family is just so fabulous. I want to add one other thing here, and this, I don't know if people are going to understand it quite the way I mean it, but I was thinking about this earlier today, and I'm thinking about our relationship, and there's a satisfaction with knowing you and your family for me personally. And of course, you can't do that with every strategic partner. I mean, we've got 1,700 of them right now, you know, so it's just not going to happen, but it does happen sometimes. But there's also, to me, a sense that your involvement with us, even apart from me personally knowing you, has drawn you into a tighter organic relationship with Stand to Reason. It's one thing to listen to things and to read things. It's another thing to be a regular, committed part of a project, and that I use the word cadre to describe it, you know, but it's for me to feel, and this is totally apart from the financial impact it has for Stand to Reason, but just knowing that there are more people that are just attaching themselves to us as an aggressive member of the community and say, we identify with you. We are part of that army of clear-thinking Christians that I have been talking about since I first started broadcasting in 1990. And it's so satisfying for me when people become strategic partners because of that element. You're attaching yourselves to us as members of our community in a much more significant way than you had before. That's really cool for me.
Well, I think that's a good observation, and I think it's almost we're needing that more as we see attacks on Christianity coming from various fronts. I think we're all feeling like we need to be equipped. We need to be ready. We need to be ready for conflict. And I think the clear thinking guidance and instruction that you continue to provide is really helps prepare us for that.
So we had I agree with you, and we had a strategic partner on last week. I asked the same question as just before we finished up our conversation, and that is, I just want you to think about somebody who's out there that's been benefiting from what we do and are really happy we're around and is thinking now whether they should be one of the 100, to put it simply. What would you say to them?
I think God gives us the ability to help and to support ministries around us. And I think as we are able, I think I've always felt like I want to support ministries that I think are making a difference.
Uh-huh.
And I certainly have never doubted for a moment that Stand to Reason was making a difference. And we also attended one of the Rethink conferences a couple of years ago, too.
Uh-huh.
And that's another way that you're reaching young people, which is so critical.
Yeah, now called reality.
Reality now,
yeah.
That's right.
I keep making the same mistake, you know.
Yes, and so I think as the Lord leads and as the Lord makes us able, I've always sort of thought, well, I want to support my local church, but I really even consider Stand to Reason part of the church. It's not as if it has to be, well, you've got to give here to the church, and then if you've got a little some crumbs left over, then maybe you want to support some of these other ministries. I feel like it is on the front line of defending the cause of Christ to the culture in a every bit of meaningful way as a church is. In fact, sadly, for most churches, more so.
Well, I agree with you, and I like to think of it sometimes with regards to local churches and their pastors. We're here, Pastor, to help solve a problem that you can't solve yourself. You need a teammate. We know how to do this. It's not in your not in your wheelhouse, but it certainly is in ours, and we can make this happen. And so that's the mentality. And so you're right. We're part of the broader body of Christ. Just to let folks know what would happen if you sign up. If you become part of the cadre, we're going to say thanks by sending you the DVD set and a digital download of our fantastic 2020 Reality Conference, which, you know, Mark, I think in Texas, we didn't have it last year, and we didn't have it here in Southern California. So a lot of people missed that one, and we're going to make that available. And I'm just looking at the layout here. I think we got a J. Warner Wallace does two talks, Elisa Childers, Sean McDowell, Alan Schliemann, Bobby Conway. I do a presentation. Oh, excellent. Elisa does two. It's a great series, 9 in-depth teaching DVD digital download. That the event is called Truth Is Not Ice Cream. And if you join as a strategic partner today for $25 a month or more, I know you're going to make a huge difference. You're going to be part of an organic member of a team that is huge to us, that is our financial foundation. And you can be one of the 100. All you have to do is go to str.org/partner. That's str.org/partner. And if you don't remember the /partner part, just go to str.org. I'm sure you'll find some place where it's talking about be one of the 100. And Mark, I'm so thrilled just to have you as a friend and your family, your wonderful family, and of course Sue, and your support over the many, many years. And I look forward to the next time we can see each other again.
Thank you so much, Greg. It's all our pleasure and our blessing. So we'll continue to pray as well as financial support. So yes.
Both are critical, and thank you so much. Absolutely. Okay, friends, this is we need to take a break here, and then we'll get back to your calls on Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
Do you know that killing an unborn human being is against the law in most states? The only exception is when the mother wants her child dead and asks a doctor to kill it. Then it's legal. It's protected. It's funded by our tax dollars. And today, the freedom to choose is even celebrated. We live in a world where a woman decides whether another innocent and defenseless human being lives or dies. But is it that simple? Don't women have a right to control their own bodies? Can't many poor women not afford to have another baby? Should a woman who was raped be forced to carry the criminal's baby? It's complicated. It's chaos. But there's a solution. There's a way to make sense of the confusion. We need to anchor our thinking about abortion to reality. Then we'll see how we can help both unborn human beings as well as their born mothers who face a difficult decision. Join us for this year's Reality Conference, where we'll see how the solution to abortion will bring clarity to the chaos. Go to realityapologetics.com to get dates and locations for the Student Apologetics event of the year.
When you choose to support Stand to Reason with a monthly gift of $10 or more, you become a strategic partner in the work of equipping Christian ambassadors. Your monthly commitment makes you a part of a special group, helping STR train Christians to confidently and graciously defend their convictions. Your monthly gift helps us plan and manage STR's resources and provides consistent support to aid our ongoing work. As our thanks for your partnership, we have created some benefits to express our gratitude, like a 10% discount in our online store, access to a private Facebook group, and more. To become a strategic partner, visit str.org/donate. Click How Often Will You Donate? And choose Monthly. For personal assistance, you can email Ocean Wilson at ocean@str.org.
All right, friends, Greg Kochel here. And what I haven't done is said anything this particular show about, I almost said rethink. See, it's old habits die hard. Kyle, can you close that door for me? I'm sorry, I forgot to close my studio door. Reality coming up. Did I mention? We got 3 weeks. I did mention in passing, maybe 4 weeks, to Orange County Reality, September 24th and 25th. This particular series, starting in September and going through the spring, so it's like the school year. We got six different locations. We're trying to box the compass as much as possible and making a reality available to everyone. This is called Chaos to Clarity because we know about the chaos that many of your kids are facing. And we want to bring clarity. It's very similar to what I was talking about the last show, that there are certain basic things that are being challenged now in the world that are not they're not ambiguous in Scripture and with the Christian worldview. So this session of training apologetics is we are not doing apologetics to the outside world, though we're happy when non-Christians come and sit in and listen to what we have to say, no problem. But what we are aimed at doing is motivating the next generation, passing the baton to your middle schooler, to your high schooler, so that they have the capability of not only standing firm in their own convictions. And as I've said before, apologetics will help you deal with the toughest critic you'll ever face, and that is yourself or one of your kids. But will also help them to be a change agent for the cause of Christ in the world that they are going into. Okay, that's the goal. And Chaos to Clarity, we're dealing with a lot of crazy things that they're going to face, like talks on how to persevere under opposition, okay, or how to bring clarity to science and faith, or talk on called Identity Theft by Monique Dusson, or Dusson, and she was on board with this last week, and dealing with critical race theory, okay, true for you but not for me. Why does God care about sex? So, you know, these are all the kinds of things that they're being challenged with in their communities. And what we are doing is we're going to equip them to understand the biblical worldview and to be able to represent it to others even while under fire. So that's the lineup. Orange County, September 24th and 25th. Seattle, that's actually Bellevue, the greater Seattle area, October 15 and 16. And by the way, advanced signups are open for that. So you can save some money through August 21st. That's the early bird deadline in Seattle. And we're pushing 400 people there already. And we still got, 10 weeks before? That's October. So that's more than we had last time, though we had some restrictions last time. We're still moving way ahead of those. Our attendance in Minneapolis, St. Paul, November 12th and 13th. That's Grace Church Eden Prairie, the largest church in the state. We'll be in Dallas on February 25th and 26th. It will be in Philly, March 25th and 26th, and Augusta, Georgia, April 22nd and 23rd. So that's the lineup. If you want to get the details, just go to realityapologetics.com, and you'll see all the information for each of the events around the country to help us pass the baton to your young person, or to you if you are a young person. All right, here we go. Okay, let's talk with Daniel. Daniel in Georgia somewhere. Welcome to the show, Daniel.
Hi, Mr. Koval.
Hello, sir.
How are you?
I'm doing pretty good.
That's great. So, I just had a question. I wanted to see, like, how would you respond if you were in this situation?
Okay.
So I was online, and it was an atheist. She was talking about, you know, the problem of evil.
Uh-huh.
And people were in her comments responding to her, like, letting her know that, well, basically simplifying, telling her about God's sovereign, how wouldn't it be, it would kind of be evil for him to intervene or override our free will. And she responded by saying that she didn't really buy that, because she was saying that, I guess she used to be an ex-Christian, and she was saying how multiple, throughout the Bible, God overrided people's free will, like Daniel and Jonah in the Bible. And I was wondering, like, how would you respond to that if you were, asked with that?
Sure. I actually think she's onto something in a certain way, but that's because I have a particular understanding about how freedom works and God interacts with that. Okay, and it, I mean, it's not a bizarre understanding. But unfortunately, there are a lot of Christians who will simply say, God will never interfere with your free will. I actually don't think that's a true statement. I don't think it's a biblical statement, though a lot depends on what is meant by free will. But clearly you've got God intervening and influencing, and, you know, he had Nebuchadnezzar eating grass for, what, 3 years or 4 years or something before he finally came to his senses and gave glory to God. That's in the book of Daniel. So, I mean, was he interfering with Nebuchadnezzar's free will? There, he was being pretty persuasive. Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? And bang, you go blind. So what's up with that? And so I don't buy the idea that God will never interfere with your free will. Secondly, I am glad God interfered with the free choices I was making to rebel against him and run the other direction. Because had he not interfered with my freedom, I would not be a Christian and I would be under the judgment of God. So the idea that God will not violate our free will and that would be evil for him to do that, I don't buy that line of thinking. I don't have any reason to believe that's true, that he'll never violate our freedom. And there certainly is no biblical teaching to that effect. Now, I'm not saying that we don't have freedom in some meaningful sense. I'm not saying that God will always interfere with our freedom and he doesn't respect the choices that we freely make. I think those are true, too. I'm just pushing back on the blanket statement that God will never interfere with that. That I don't think it's true. Okay. Now, as far as the free will working into the whole issue of the problem of evil, and I guess that was the discussion. Is that right, Daniel?
Yes.
So I'm always curious when an atheist enters into this discussion and raises the issue of the problem of evil. And in one sense, it's predictable, but in another sense, it's odd. Because I'm going to ask that person, tell me, when you say things are evil, what are you talking about? What things do you mean? Oh, and then they might mention things like, murder and tsunamis, or even your own disability, for example, with blindness, and identify that as an evil. And my question then is, what you've done is you've given examples of what you think is evil, but you haven't told me what is evil about those things. What makes those things evil? As opposed to, why didn't you say, well, evil is being kind to people, or evil is loving people? Why didn't you say those things were evil? There must, in other words, what I'm getting at here, Daniel, is there must be a criterion people have kind of in their minds, in some sense, that allows them to distinguish between the evil things and the good things, and then make, in that distinction, raise the question, how could a good and powerful God allow the evil things? Like, for example, blindness. Am I on track so far?
Yes, you are.
Okay. The problem here for the atheist is the atheist has no categories in their worldview that allows them to make this distinction. They can talk about things they like or they don't like, or even things that they might call evil because evolutionists tricked them into calling those things evil, but they can't make sense of things that are actually evil in themselves. And the reason is almost every atheist is a materialist. They don't believe in the immaterial realm. They just believe that just molecules clashing in the universe. So when it comes to the problem of evil, which really amounts to things are not the way they're supposed to be, but how can they not be the way they're supposed to be if there's no supposer, so to speak,
yeah.
Right? There is no such thing in atheism. There is no way it's supposed to be. It just is.
Yeah, things just are.
Yeah, you're not supposed to be having sight because you weren't made to have sight. It just turns out that most people do and you don't. And that's all you can say about it from an atheist perspective. So I think when atheists start talking about the problem of evil, they are on very dangerous ground given their worldview. You and I, are you a Christian, Daniel? I guess I was assuming that, but I'm not sure.
Yes, I am.
Okay, so you and I at least can make sense of the concept of evil because we understand where good comes from, and we understand that the good thing God made got broken.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we call evil, the brokenness of the world. It's not as good as he made it. Something caused it to go south. One might argue that it was human freedom that caused that. Okay, that's a way of pursuing that. But the point is we have a way of understanding reality that makes sense of a broken world. It's not the way it's supposed to be because there was a way that it was supposed to be that God made that way, and then it went bad. And it went bad because human beings made choices that broke the world and broke them. Now, whether or not somebody believes that accounting, at least that makes sense to the way the world actually is broken. But the atheist has to say, well, in the beginning were the particles, and right now it's all particles moving around, and the particles look different than they did before in different shapes, but that's it. There's no way it's supposed to be. Well, if there's no way it's supposed to be, then there can't be any way it's not supposed to be. And so you can't say blindness or murder or pillaging of some sort are the way they're not supposed to be.
Yeah.
It just is. It's just the way it is. As Richard Dawkins famously put it, see if I can recall the quote, there's no evil, there's no good, there is nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. Well, if you're an atheist, that's really all that's left. So atheists, they don't have a place at the table here. And I'm not trying to throw them out. I'm just saying that their worldview disallows them from being part of the conversation on this. Now, that doesn't solve the question of how is it that a good God could exist and a powerful God and there be evil in the world. And that can be the solution to that problem. Well, let me put it this way. There have been different kinds of solutions offered, and I offer one way of looking at it in the story of reality. But there are different ways to different speculations on how that can be worked out. But these are called theodicies, and you can read books of theodicies, which are ways of trying to explain how there can be a good God and a powerful God and evil in the world. But I tell you one thing is there's no contradiction there. Yeah, okay, good for you. No one has ever been able to demonstrate in a logically tight way how there is a contradiction. And that's because it certainly seems possible that a powerful good God could have a morally sufficient reason for allowing evil for a while. And as long as that's possible, then there's no contradiction. And what I offer in the story of reality is a characterization of that. In other words, here's a way of looking at it that in which it makes sense that God could be morally justified in allowing evil for a season. And that's really all we need to at least answer the alleged contradiction that people have raised regarding evil and God in the world. But, you know, I don't know the full answer to this. What I do know is that I have every reason to believe that God is good, and that he is, especially when one is in relationship with him, as you are and as I am, that he is using the hard things in our lives, the difficult things in our lives, to form us in a way that we would not be formed without them. That makes sense?
Yeah, I agree. But I believe that, you know, God can bring good from evil or good from bad.
Mm-hmm. I'm just curious, if you don't mind answering this question, and if you just say I'd rather not talk about it, then that's fine. I'm just curious, as you reflect on your own disability, and by the way, have you been blind all your life?
No, I'm not blind, no.
Oh, I thought you said you were blind.
Oh, no.
Okay. Well, never mind. I don't know where that came from. You know, I misheard something, which is not surprising since I'm a bit deaf, all right, even with my headsets on. I was having a problem with another headset. I had a switch. So, okay, my error then. Just so regardless, I am sure that there are things that you can look at in your life that have not been the way you planned them or wanted them. Is that fair?
Yeah, I can agree with that.
Okay, that's true with me too, big time, all right. But would it be fair, and you don't even have to go into detail here, but would it be fair for you to say that you are able to see in some of the circumstances at least how that thing that seemed bad in the moment turned out to be something God used for good in your life somewhere down the line?
Oh, most definitely.
Yeah. I agree with you too. And that gives me, and it seems to me, I talked about this on the air not too long ago, but I look back at things in my life as being, you know, many things that have happened that, boy, I'm in the midst of, and I say, oh, OMG, right? What is going on? Yet I discover as I walk with the Lord and seek to trust Him in the midst of it and do the right thing as best I know it in the midst of all kinds of temptation to do the wrong thing because I'm in agony about it, I've seen God work changes in me that needed to be made. So that's a kind of theodicy. It's called a soul-making theodicy, and that I think that's part of the solution, but it's not the whole thing. So does that help, Daniel?
Yes, it does, Mr. Copel. Thank you.
Oh, you're so welcome. Glad to hear from you anytime you want to call and chat, okay?
All right. Thank you. Have a nice day.
Okay. So long, buddy. Let's go to a quick break, and then we'll talk to Tobias in Australia from Down Under after that. Friends, if you like this broadcast, I know you'll love hashtag STRAsk. It's our shorter 20-minute podcast where I am paired with the wonderful Amy Hall, and together we answer the questions you send us on Twitter. Hashtag STRAsk is released twice a week, Mondays and Thursdays, and it's only about 20 minutes long, so it's perfect to listen to on your morning jog or while driving around running errands or cleaning your garage or just plain loafing at home. Amy and I tackle your questions on theology and ethics and culture and lots more, offering our insight on the questions you're asking or the challenges you face. You can listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your own shows. Just remember, send us your questions on Twitter using the name of the podcast, hashtag STRAsk. That's hashtag STRAsk.
As a high school teacher, I always had a red pen close at hand. When I wasn't in front of my students teaching a lesson, you could find me assessing assignments, grading essays, and evaluating exams. The red pen played a crucial role in the educational development of my students. With it, I questioned their assumptions, exposed their errors, and challenged them to think critically. You see, a good teacher doesn't merely tell his students that they're wrong. A good teacher shows his students why they're wrong so they don't make the same mistakes twice. He corrects because he cares. Last year, I was scrolling through social media, and frankly, I was discouraged at all the bad thinking that undergirded much of what I was reading. Then it hit me. What if someone applied the red pen to this flawed thinking? And Red Pen Logic with Mr. B was born. In the last few months, Red Pen Logic has grown in popularity. Through our engaging and shareable educational graphics and videos, we are helping people, especially young people, assess bad thinking by using good thinking. And we have a lot of fun in the process. So here's your homework assignment. Like the Red Pen Logic Facebook page so you don't miss our next graphic. And subscribe at the Red Pen Logic YouTube channel so you don't miss a single video. Class dismissed.
By the way, Tim's right. That is, if you have not gone to RPL, Red Pen Logic on YouTube, and it's really simple. You go to YouTube and then, did I say YouTube? You go to YouTube and type in Red Pen Logic and you're there. What is it with my lips right now? I better slow down and be more careful. I might say something I don't want to say. Go to YouTube, type in Red Pen Logic and go right there. And like he said, if you like it, then like it. And if you like it in the second sense, then you will be notified every time a new one goes up. I work with Tim on these, and I have a load of fun. He's the brainchild of the project. He's the brainchild of the basic ideas. I help wordsmith a few things with him and come up with maybe some little twists and turns along the way. But it's mostly his project, and it is fabulous. I don't know what the numbers are, people following and subscribing now, but it's a lot, and they subscribe because for a reason. So you're looking at like a 5 to 7 minute piece of your time to get a good education dealing with a challenge that has been raised against Christianity. Okay, so, and now we go down under to Tobias. Tobias, mate.
Hey, g'day, how are you?
G'day, mate. I'm doing fine. Are you just waking up down there, or what time is it?
No, I've been awake for a while. I have a 14-month-old child, so there is no such thing as sleep anymore.
Oh, so your whole world is upside down in more ways than one.
Yeah, 10:45 in the morning here.
Okay. All right. Well, great to have you on board again.
I just want to apologize ahead if it's a little noisy. I'm just near this doing a delivery, and there happens to now be a very loud forklift right next to me.
Oh, I see. I actually don't hear it, so maybe we're okay. We got noise filtering or something going on. So what's on your mind today, Tobias?
Well, I'm obviously a pro-life, and I want to get more involved in the movement here in Australia. But so I'm in a moment, I'm in a place and time in my life where I'm trying to do more research and get in touch with those people, you know, who have their boots on the ground, who are actually dealing with this stuff. And then I was just having a chat with my best mate about the abortion issue, and we're both pro-lifers in the sense, well, I'm a full pro-lifer. I think he kind of thinks there's certain occasions when abortion can be seen as ethical or moral because of the greater good. Well, I sort of disagreed with him, but he did raise a question that even I thought, that's a good one.
Mm-hmm.
With stem cell research and all the medical advances that they're claiming that, you know, they're getting from the aborted babies, the question was, well, my friend posted, he said, if people are going to have abortion, so you might as well use the, you know, and I hate to say it, use the dead babies for research. And I mean, for me, I was conflicted by this, and I thought, geez, I get what you're saying. And I think I just want your point of view on this, because I guess my view is, I think, and I pushed back with him saying, you know, I can understand if the child is dead or anyone, it's always a sad thing. It's always morally bad when someone dies. And, you know, like we have donors who donate the organs. And if, you know, if a child has died, even through an abortion, and someone decides to go, okay, well, let's use the cells, and that's gonna benefit so many people outside. The only problem I pushed back with him was, well, you're condoning abortion because you're creating more of a need. And although I can understand that someone would want to go, well, hey, if people are going to have abortions, you've got these dead bodies, basically, and we might as well use them. That was his kind of view. But for me, I think it's a conflict of interest as a Christian, or just as a human being in general, because although, yeah, I get it, you want to use the stem cells and all that sort of stuff, you're creating more of a need, and therefore you're supporting abortion.
Right. Okay, this is a little bit morally complex. And what I'll do is lay out a couple of things for you. It's a great question. And I know more and more people are thinking about it, especially when vaccines come into play, because vaccines oftentimes are part of this process, benefiting at least at some stage of the development of the vaccines from the cells of an aborted fetus. Child.
Well, I found that out recently through my friend, because he works in the medical field.
Yeah, okay.
He's starting to be a nurse, and he enlightened me on that.
So, but some distinctions need to be... Oh, and I'll also say that well-meaning, thoughtful Christians are going to come out down on different sides of this issue, all right? So let me try to share some of the features that I think are relevant. One you've already mentioned, I used to have my high school sweetheart when we went to college at Michigan State University was in a medical profession. And so I would go visit her down in the basement where she was doing work on corpses. And these were corpses that they got from the morgue. And sometimes these are John Doe's, right? They don't know who they are. They just find them dead. Sometimes they're murdered. Okay. So even though they have been killed illicitly, in an immoral fashion, their life was taken. There seemed to be no problem with using these bodies for medical research and bringing some good out of it, because in that circumstance, people weren't being murdered for the purpose of selling their corpses to the university to have people do examinations in the human necropsy lab, you know, kind of thing. So notice that in that circumstance, it is the use of the dead human beings and their tissue does not create a market that increases the killing. Okay, so to me, this is really a critical distinction. Now, there are some people who are going to say, "No, it's worse than that. If children are being killed and there is a medical use of these children, the bodies that are left over, then that casts aspersions on the legitimacy of the medical use itself." And this is an argument that people had in the 40s because of what the Nazis did. You had Nazi doctors that were using human beings as scientific experiments. One of the things that they used them for was to test the effects of hypothermia. And so they would submerge these victims into cold to see what happened, even to the point of them dying, and they're keeping the record. All right. Now, this is grotesque, obviously. However, there was benefit from what they learned. And some people would argue, well, even though they died at the hands of this merciless people on this medical project, there's a redemptive element for taking what was learned and using it to save other lives. All right. Now, that's the view I hold. And that is just because the information or the material even were gained from a corpse that was whose life was taken illicitly doesn't mean that good use can't be made out of the body if it does not increase the market for that material. So if I'm going to, if there's a market then for baby body parts, that the use of that increases the demand for more baby body parts so that more babies are killed, that's when you cross the line. I don't mind
that's how
even
I feel too.
If it increases the demand, that's not a problem as long as it doesn't increase the deaths. If it does increase the deaths, well, then I think the purchasing of this material or the use of it for science is creating a market pressure that increases the abuse and the death. So that's where you cross the line. Now, there are people who are good Christians who disagree with that, and I honor them, and they have to make their own decisions about this. In the issue of stem cell research, there's two different types of stem cell research. There's what they call adult stem cell research and embryonic stem cell research. Now, adult stem cell research isn't necessarily stem cells that come from adults, but they're stem cells that come from humans who are not blastula, who are not stem cells. They're not embryos is what I mean. In the very earliest stages, just think of an orange. You've got an orange. If you take the peel off an orange, it's got sections. If you take the sections away, then what you have is the sections and no more orange. So you destroy the orange in sectioning out the parts. In embryonic stem cell research, you have the orange, which is the embryo, which is a full human being, and then they take the pieces of that human being, just like the pieces of an orange, and they destroy the human being to get the parts in use. So that is radically immoral, because you are taking a human being and which you made just for the purpose of dismembering it and destroying it and using its parts.
Yeah.
Now, that's different from a child that is conceived the regular way and then is aborted, and that's wrong. But what do you do with what's left? Well, you could take umbilical cord material or material from the child itself, and maybe use that to start stem cell lines. And these would be adult stem cell lines that can be used for something good. And I don't see a problem with that personally. Now, it's a little icky if you think about it. Not the umbilical cord part, but the body part. If you're taking parts from the baby who has been aborted, that's icky. But it may not be immoral. If people think it's icky enough they don't want to be involved with it, that's up to them. If they think it's too close to the killing of the baby, then they don't have to do it either. Then don't do it. You know, then that's up to them too. But as a strictly ethical issue, in my view at least, if benefit can be gained from a terrible thing that happened, then we should take the benefit from that if taking the benefit does not increase the incidence of the terrible thing like abortion.
It's kind of like that saying, you know, if the cure is worse than the disease, then maybe the cure is not the right thing.
Yeah, something like that. Very, very broadly. But what we don't want to do is participate in a way that encourages the commission of another heinous crime. If all we're doing is benefiting from the results of a crime that has already been committed, and the benefits are something that are genuinely good for humanity, then I think that the benefits become a redemptive element of a terrible circumstance. So knock that around with your friend. I mean, there's a mouthful there. And like I said, different Christians who survey the details here and think about them carefully are going to come up with different conclusions. And so it's a matter of individual, in my view, I guess, it's a matter of individual conscience what you do. But I think there is an argument that's legitimate for the use of those things, but I think we have to be careful to reflect on the long-term consequence of doing that. And sorry, we just missed you. Go ahead. Hold on just a minute.
No, I was just going to say I agree 100%. And I think my best mate, like, obviously he's not for abortion at all. But, you know, he sees certain cases going, well, you know, what if it's rare cases where it has to happen? And, you know, what do we do with that material? You know,
yeah, right.
When we see the advances in science and all that. And that was something I thought I've never really thought
right,
about before.
Right.
I might ponder on that.
Sure. Let me jump in here. Whether it has to happen or not is another question. That's another moral question. But given that it does happen, then the question is, what do we do with what's left? And that's what we were discussing. Great to talk to you again, Tobias. Got to run. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven, friends. Bye-bye now.